Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's almost like the big numbers don't mean anything anymore. One of Europe's biggest banks announced this morning it's going to write off $10 billion in subprime debt. Write it off, as in all gone, $10 billion. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. It's the 10th of December today. And the more the accountants look, the worse the news gets. Last quarter, the Swiss bank UBS announced it was $2.5 billion poorer because of U.S. subprime woes. Today, it added another $10 billion to the total. But with gray clouds do come the occasional silver lining for somebody. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from New York. An investment company set up by the government of Singapore has bought a nearly $10 billion stake in UBS.
Sovereign wealth funds like Singapore's are on a bit of a shopping spree for Western banks. Last month, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority bought a nearly 5% stake in Citigroup. China recently took a stake in Barclays, Dubai, and Deutsche Bank. Kenneth Rogoff teaches economics at Harvard. He says the mortgage crisis has left U.S. and European banks short on cash.
And these banks in the Middle East and Asia have tons of money, and they're swooping in and buying up stock.
And they're getting it cheap. Financial stocks have tumbled in the last 6 months. Analyst Jeffrey Hart of Sandler O'Neill says a global slowdown could drive share prices lower. But he sees the sovereign funds' investments in banks as a vote of confidence.
When you have large investors who really can choose from any industry or any asset class, when they actually single out an industry, that's usually a good sign that valuations have bottomed.
It's not just banks. Last month, Abu Dhabi bought an 8% stake in U.S. chipmaker AMD. Law professor Henry Hugh of the University of Texas worries foreign governments could wield too much influence over U.S. companies.
Present intentions can change, and current friendly relations between one country and another may not necessarily stay that way.
Hugh adds sovereign wealth funds have bought large amounts of U.S. Treasury bonds. That's kept interest rates low for consumers. If they decide to buy other investments instead, Hugh says we could all end up paying more to borrow money. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One more subprime note to leave you with before we move on. Washington Mutual announced late this afternoon it's going to cut 3,000 jobs as it tries to find its way back to profitability. It's also looking for somebody willing to part with $2.5 billion to shore up its operations. Morgan Stanley added fuel to the economic fire today. The bank's economists said a recession is now officially likely. They did say it would be a mild one, though. Breakfast, we are told, is the most important meal of the day, and plenty of us take that to heart, even if it means grabbing something on the way to work. McDonald's said today our on-the-go habits are part of the reason U.S. sales were up more than 4% over the same time last year. The rest of the world looks even better, a 10% gain in Europe, higher still in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. It wasn't so long ago that McDonald's was suffering for being on the unfashionably unhealthy end of the food pyramid, but their fortunes have changed along with their menus, as Ashley Miltite reports.
After all, you need a coffee with that Egg McMuffin. Sarah Lockyer is financial editor at Nation's Restaurant News. She says since McDonald's started touting its premium coffee, sales have been stellar, and the chain is poised to introduce new equipment into its stores that could bring customers the McLatte.
And they're projecting to get an extra $1 billion in incremental sales. That would be on top of everything else that they're hoping to get strictly from espresso beverage rollouts.
Newer menu items like snack wraps have also boosted sales, as has late night or round-the-clock opening. Lockyer says McDonald's has won customers outside the US with some pretty basic changes. She says the atmosphere and decor in foreign outlets used to leave much to be desired, but things have improved.
Less of the plastic chairs that you used to see bolted to the floor back in the day. Better crew uniforms, making sure the bathrooms are clean.
McDonald's isn't the only fast food chain polishing its image with customers and investors. David Henkes is with Technomic Incorporated, a food industry research firm.
They're clearly outperforming fast food as a whole, but fast food in general is doing pretty good. It's really appealing right now to consumers' need for value, for convenience, for on-the-go food.
He says there is evidence that consumers are swapping visits to pricier restaurants for a trip to a fast food joint. And for those who are feeling squeezed, he says McDonald's seems to offer a better combination of taste and value than its competitors. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Former newspaper mogul Conrad Black was sentenced today for his role in fleecing shareholders out of nearly $6 million. Black used to run Hollinger International, a big newspaper publisher. Depending on who you ask, he got off easy. He was sentenced to 6.5 years in jail. Prosecutors had asked for 30 years. Union leaders from around the world have gathered for a two-day meeting of the AFL-CIO. The title of the conference is called Going Global, Organizing, Recognition, and Union Rights, which is kind of a mouthful for what they're really going to be talking about, the freedom, or lack thereof, to form unions in certain parts of the world. Labor chiefs will also be urging the passage of the Employee Free Choice Act. They argue it'll level the playing field for workers and employers and help rebuild America's middle class. These are tough times for unions, as Jeremy Hobson reports from Washington.
In the 1950s, about 35% of American workers were unionized. Today, 12%.
It's shocking.
That's Stuart Acuff, the AFL-CIO's National Organizing Director. He says among developed nations, the U.S. is not providing nearly the protections for unions that other countries do.
Our policies have not kept up with the change in the global economy.
John Beck heads the labor education program at Michigan State University. He says in order for unions to regain traction, legal protections have to catch up with the times. For instance, benefits should be transferable from one company to another.
Those kinds of legal realities are going to have to shift as work becomes far more mobile, as people try to come to grips with not only what the demands of the workplace are, but what the demands of a new workforce are.
Tomorrow, Congress will hear from union leaders directly on strengthening workers' rights. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
At the moment, Ben Bernanke is probably going over his notes for tomorrow's meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee. The central bank is widely expected to cut interest rates. Could be a half a point, could be a quarter. The announcement is set for 2:15 tomorrow, Washington time. Wall Street is already primed for it. The major indices rose 0.5% or more today. And think for a second about this turn of events. The Dow Industrials are just 400 points from their all-time high. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Al Gore took a trip up to Oslo, Norway this weekend. He was there to pick up the Nobel Peace Prize that he won for his work on global warming. His speech today was televised to a United Nations meeting in Bali, Indonesia, where representatives from 190 countries are trying to figure out what to do when the Kyoto Treaty on Climate Change expires in 2012. Sam Eaton has been following that meeting for us from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. Hiya, Sam.
Hey, Guy.
So what we have here is the White House down at the meeting in Bali sort of holding the line against limitations on greenhouse gas emissions. Meanwhile, back in Washington, the Senate is about to pass a climate change bill that would do exactly that, put limits on greenhouse gas emissions. How's that playing down at the UN conference?
Kai, it really puts the U.S. in an awkward position in these negotiations. It's seen as the elephant in the room. The U.S. position basically hasn't changed since the Kyoto Protocol was first passed in 1997, the U.S., of course, not being signatory to that. And that position is that any binding reductions in greenhouse gas emissions would harm the U.S. economy and aren't particularly fair if developing countries like China and India and Brazil aren't included in those binding agreements. I talked to Angela Anderson with the National Environmental Trust, who's been attending the meetings in Bali, and she says the foreign countries are well aware of the change that's happening on the state side and in Congress in the U.S.
All of those changes taken together are quite heartening for the rest of the world. They, of course, want a solid commitment from the United States, but they have a two-year negotiating window, and they know that this administration is only going to be there for one of those years.
Timing is everything, of course, and they can read the calendar as well as the rest of us can. But what's that doing on the ground in these negotiations?
Well, Kai, it's really shifted, at least for the next coming year, as long as the Bush administration is still in power. It's really shifted some of the focus of these talks. Adaptation has been pushed up to have equal footing with mitigation, which is actually reducing CO2 emissions.
All right. So mitigation means reducing. Adaptation means what?
Adaptation, Kai, is when countries, especially poor nations, start to think about ways to prevent flooding from rising sea levels, drought, all of the kind of plague and disaster that comes along with global warming.
Give me an example of what's happening on the ground.
Well, one of the key issues, and this is where we may see some agreement in the coming week, is deforestation. Now, this is causing some 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions. It's even more than transportation worldwide. Now, the idea here is to get rich nations to pay poorer rainforest nations like Indonesia not to cut down their forests, basically putting a financial value on the services these forests provide, which is sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere.
When you start talking about financial compensation for services provided, that, of course, is another way of saying a business opportunity. Is there business involvement in these negotiations, or is it just a government-to-government thing?
There definitely is business involvement here, Kai, and this is another area where there's been a huge shift in the past decade. Over the weekend, the trade ministers were meeting in parallel talks to the Bali climate change meetings. And then today and tomorrow, finance ministers are meeting to hammer out kind of the economic effects, how to guide this policy and make sure that the economic and business impacts are included in that. Now, you have to remember here, Kai, that there was a recent UN study that reported some hundreds of billions of dollars need to be invested over the next two decades in order to move us away from a fossil fuel-based economy. For businesses, they see this as a huge opportunity, and they want to make sure they have a seat at the table.
Sam, before we let you go, quickly, it's important to point out these are negotiations about negotiations, right?
Kai, it is important. This is only the beginning. We're looking at 2 years of negotiations leading up to the next climate treaty.
So you'll be back then, right?
I will.
Sam Eaton from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Kai.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson will lead a gang of high-level trade negotiators into Beijing tomorrow. It's the latest round of regularly scheduled talks in which the U.S. leans on China to let its currency rise, and China politely declines. Mr. Paulson and company want American goods to have an easier time competing against cheaper Chinese imports. But Marketplace's Scott Tong reports it's not all rosy for Chinese manufacturers either, and that could mean more iffy Chinese products for Americans.
In the industrial city of Wenzhou in eastern China, one of the loneliest professions is that of the musician. Wenzhou native Xu Shunshi says for most of his friends, it's all business all the time here. So hobbies, forget about it.
Because they're all pursuing their careers, they have no time for the orchestra or for an opera or a movie. No time.
Wenzhou businessmen are legendary in China for eking out profits for low-end manufactured goods. But the gig may be up. Take cigarette lighters. Wenzhou workers make 70% of the world's refillable ones. But China's currency has inched up 12% against the dollar the last 2 years. That makes these lighters pricier against the competition. Li Zhongjian is founder of the Dongfang Lighter Company.
It's a watershed. With the UN appreciating, a lot of small companies can't handle that. If you offer a price today and the UN jumps tomorrow, your slim margin gets eaten up.
He can't raise his prices because of overcapacity. Too many lighters, not enough smokers. Li says a few years back, 3,000 lighter makers thrived here. Now, a few dozen. And it's not just the currency pinch. The cost of raw materials is sky high these days, and wages are creeping up too. It's all cut profit margins by 10% last year. And for fiercely competitive, low-margin makers, that translates into Darwinian shakeout.
Well, the first place I saw it was in Taiwan.
Corporate attorney Steve Dickinson has worked in Asia for 30 years.
The wages went through the roof, and the manufacturing had to go somewhere else. I also saw it happen in Japan, and I've seen it happen in Korea.
Today, that somewhere else includes even lower-cost places like Vietnam and Indonesia. Higher input costs also create another problem, pressure to cut corners.
If the price doesn't move up, then something else has got to give, and we can see where it's been giving, and that lead paint in the toys is exactly the kind of place where it gives.
Statistically, these product substitution cases are rare, but given the margin squeeze, Dickinson won't be surprised to read more anecdotes, more scary China headlines in the next 2 years. For Beijing, there is a good side to all this. The leaders want to cool an economy running at an 11% clip. And in the long run, survival of the fittest makes the survivors, well, fitter. The Wenzhou conglomerate Chint, for instance, now makes more widgets with more technology and with fewer people. It spits out an electric power gauge in just 2 hours. Once upon a time, it took 7 days.
And for my feet, just Geox.
Wenzhou shoemaker Ao Kang is moving up the food chain by building a more upscale, profitable brand. It partners with the Italian brand Geox to make high-end shoes that go for 150 U.S.
The shoe that breathes.
Company executive Zhou Wei.
The ultimate goal is to raise our prices. We can't keep selling low-cost goods. The global marketplace doesn't even want them.
Ao Kang is also creating customers at home, and their pockets are increasingly getting deeper. Again, Steve Dickinson.
Higher wages means more capacity to spend so that they can create a non-export-oriented domestic economy where really quality products from the United States and Europe will be in demand.
Could Hank Paulson have said it any better? In Wenzhou, eastern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, pitching in to help out an economy on the skids.
You could do this business much easier anywhere else. Logistically, it's a nightmare.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 101 points today, 0.75% to 13,727. The NASDAQ edged up 12 points, about 0.5%, 2718 at the close there. The S&P 500 snagged 11 points, 0.75% to 1515. Expectations that the Federal Reserve is going to trim interest rates buoyed banks, mortgage lenders, and home builders today. D.R. Horton, the country's second largest home builder, bounced 6.5% higher after contracts to buy previously owned homes rose for the second month. U.S. Bancorp rose more than 2% today. Bank of America climbed nearly 3%. J.P. Morgan got a bump after the Investment Corporation of Dubai said it was talking up with the number three U.S. bank on ways to cooperate. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Science and Technology Reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Open Market Committee meets to discuss interest rates. A Senate committee holds a hearing on the legal rights of Guantanamo detainees. And on December 11, 1946, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund was established. UNICEF aims to help children and women in developing countries. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. No pressure here, everybody, but we are down to just 15 shopping days until Christmas, you know, which means more of us are probably thinking about taking the easy way out, plunking down $50 for a gift card and being done with it. Analysts guess retailers are going to earn more than $26 billion from gift cards this holiday season. About a third of that will be pure profit for them, cash left behind by customers who don't redeem their credits. And that is all the more reason, says commentator Ron Lieber, that you should spare your loved ones the hassle.
It's been about 12 months since last year's holiday season, yet the scattered bounty still haunts my desk. Those iTunes gift cards, did I spend them? And L.L. Bean, is it worth my time to extract that last $3.67? As if we needed something else to keep track of, many of us now have a gift card inventory. Given with the best of intentions, gift cards are supposed to make life easier, allowing us to pick out whatever we want. But gift cards don't make life easier, as my messy desk attests. And because of that, it's just rude to give them. Put yourself in the head of the recipient, you know, the person you think you're helping with the gift of flexibility. The gift cards from stores are bad enough. If you carry them around, they add mass to your wallet. If you leave them at home, though, you won't have them when you need them. They're a pain. Then there are the gift cards that the leading credit card companies have created. They're good anywhere those cards are accepted. How great, right? But here's the problem. The giver pays a fee just to buy them, and if the getter hangs on to them for too long, they start losing their value. They're a pain, too. No matter the card, you end up spending money out of your own pocket to extract the full value. Leave $6 on a $100 gift card, and you feel like an idiot. But to extract that full $100, you'll almost certainly have to spend more, say $114. Some gift, that is. Look, if you can't be bothered with picking out an actual gift for someone, just give cash. It's easy, since ATMs have lots of it. It doesn't expire. People don't lose it. So are you worried you'll look rude or lazy to others who stormed the aisles to shop? Worry not. When you hand over the green cash money, everyone who gets it will light up in delight. And it won't sit on their desks for very long.
Ron Lieber is the managing editor for FiLife.com. That's a new personal finance website. You can send us your thoughts online. Our website is marketplace.org. There are a couple of things every new business needs. A good idea, hard work, and cash. Most companies do okay with the first two, but item three can be a little bit tricky, especially when it's social entrepreneurship we're talking about. People who are using business to help change what needs changing in this world. From his post at the Entrepreneurship Desk, Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has been taking us inside some of those companies the past couple of Mondays. Today, we focus on a small but growing source of money for them.
In the peculiar way New Englanders talk, the further up the Maine coast you go, the more you're down east. Whiting, Maine's about as down east as it gets, almost to Canada. Here in remote Washington County, there have been two economic mainstays for generations, wild blueberries and fish. Very few people have grown rich off either of them. The canning line at the old A.M. Look Company is turning out fresh-packed fish and chowders full throttle these days.
What we're doing today is lobster bisque. This is minced lobster.
It comes but a few years back, it nearly went silent after 85 years. Business was lagging badly. Then Maine native Mike Cody and his partner Cynthia Fisher said they'd revive the cannery. Mike was from these parts, and they both are on a mission to bring jobs to the struggling region. But up here, where the economy almost never booms, Fisher remembers skepticism at their plan.
Because I believe even the people here wouldn't believe that anybody would come here and try to make a business go. Because there is this myth in these areas of Maine that it just, there's nothing that's going to happen here.
Something's happening now. Looks is now Bar Harbor Foods. Sales have jumped from $800,000 to $5 million in 4 years. And the workforce has gone from 6 to 24 full-timers with good benefits. Cynthia Fisher says doing business in communities that really need jobs is part of what made them stay here.
You could do this business much easier anywhere else. Logistically, it's a nightmare. But yes, there's a huge benefit to this business. This is a business that was started here based on people who live here and work here. And I just think that we both see that as a responsibility to keep this business alive here.
Fisher and Cody are turning their entrepreneurial challenge into a marketing tool. They're using Bar Harbor's rebuilding story and sense of place, plus a new commitment to sustainable fish harvesting, to hook new customers. But they couldn't pull it off alone. It took a special kind of investment capital to remake the old dockside cannery. Cynthia Fisher describes Bar Harbor's backers this way.
They understand, especially being in Maine, that these things just don't change overnight. We have a few more challenges, and they're willing to hang in for the end game.
Giving an investment more time to work is what venture folks call patient capital, and it's Nat Henshaw's specialty. Henshaw heads CEI Ventures down in Portland. It's one of several firms that finance community development in the Northeast. Like any venture capitalist worth their salt, Henshaw and CEI's backers are in it for the money. But it's not just about profit for them.
We speak in terms of a triple bottom line: the environment, social equity, and, of course, the financial bottom line. It's not sustainable if you don't have a financial bottom line. No one's going to invest.
The cannery met several of CEI's social investing goals, so the firm pumped in $600,000. Most VCs won't even consider a deal that small because they say the transaction costs are too high. But investing small amounts in struggling rural Maine has mostly paid off. Two of CEI's three venture funds have done well for investors, the third one just okay. And companies they funded have grown from a combined 1,300 workers to twice that. Before taking on Bar Harbor Foods, Cynthia Fisher and Mike Cody were making more money in other careers. But Fisher says that when they turned to social entrepreneurship, they started looking at a bigger picture.
You know, to me, the journey is the adventure. Along the way, if you come out with some satisfaction that you did some good for the place you were in, the continuance of the planet, and the people that you may have affected their lives in a positive way, then that in itself has to be part of the reward.
In Whiting, Maine, way down east, I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
We've got some pictures and video from Steve's visit to the Bar Harbor Foods Factory on our website. You can hear his earlier stories in this series there, too. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, it just got cheaper to go to Harvard. Officials announced a plan today to reduce tuition by thousands of dollars. It's aimed at making the school more affordable to children of middle and upper middle class backgrounds. Works like this. Parents who make less than $60,000 a year get aid, grants really, to cover the full bill. Those bringing home up to $120,000 a year will only have to pay on a sliding scale as much as 10% of their income, so maybe $12,000 a year. Those earning up to $180,000 will pay a flat 10%. It's quite a bit of savings, really. Full tuition at Harvard plus room and board comes to $45,456 this year. Of course, now all the kid has to do is get into Harvard. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 101 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ added 12 points. That's 0.5%. The S&P 500 ate up 11 points, 0.75% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, professional do-gooders step up their game.
So, you know, I'm in the corporate responsibility department, you know, banging on doors and trying to get people to listen to me. Really, the best way to make change is by incorporating it into a mainstream or traditional job function.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.